Your difference is our strength. On Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
You can believe in whatever you want to believe. I will never argue with you about that or try to stop you in any way. In fact, I'll fight and die for your right to do that.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Sunday Times Rich List is out this weekend, but can the mega rich hide their wealth? And how much does it cost to get your name removed? To explore that, we're joined by former Rich List journalist and author now, Kevin Carhill. Also, another privatisation looms. The Land Registry staff were on strike this week because they say the privatisation will mean sackings for them and charges, extra charges for us. Also this week we hear about something the European Court call the right to forget. But is this just what George Orwell warned us of in his book 1984? The Ministry of Truth, who are able to airbrush newspaper articles from history. And a big feature article in Newsweek International this week about extensive Israeli spying on the United States. Why has it been, as the magazine says, mostly hushed up? Is it simply just another example of what somebody somewhere has decided is the wrong story? But to start with, I'm joined by Kevin Carhill, writer, author and former Rich List journalist. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, how are you doing?
First of all, tell us about the Rich List, when you were working on it. How was it compiled?
It was compiled from mainly Companies House. The Rich List, of particularly Philip Beresford's Rich List, is actually based on facts. It's not Cushing's. Most people don't understand that.
Okay, also, the idea of hiding your wealth, this is very important because if you just go into Companies House, you're missing most of people's wealth, many people's money now. Since, really, 1980, 1979, when exchange controls were stopped, British people's wealth is squirreled away overseas in Switzerland, the Cayman Islands, all over the place.
Oh, in terms of tax havens, we led the way. All the original tax havens were British, and the first people into them were the British aristocracy. So we have a lead there.
Okay, so yes, we started this game hiding your wealth in other parts of the world, preferably somewhere where there's hardly any tax paid. But what about the other aspect to this? Is it possible for people to deliberately get off of the Rich List so that, you know, you may be a extremely wealthy banker on all sorts of bonuses, but your name doesn't even appear?
No, most people don't. There's a set of rules with the Rich List that Philip and I put together. And if your assets aren't visible, you don't go in it. So if you're in the Cayman Islands or even Jersey, you have a very good chance of not being in it. Philip's rule is that your assets have to be visible somewhere.
Okay, so but it's not that difficult to hide them, is it? And do you think that that does go on, where people are deliberately hiding so they don't appear there, so the people don't think, gosh, this person's incredibly super rich, and maybe hassle them to try and get jobs and this sort of thing off of the people like that?
Well, way back, the first Rich List was described as a beggar and burglar's charter. The actual Rich List is quite rigid, and if you understand the limitation, there are lots of people. The bank I used to work for years ago said of our first Rich List, we'd missed 5 out of every 6. But the rule, Philip sticks to the rule, you know, if your shares are hidden in Jersey or Guernsey or Cayman Islands, you can't, you know, he won't put you in.
Well, we hear in the Bristol Post that Hargreaves Lansdown founders have risen up the Sunday Times Rich List. Just explain what happens, because we've had a few last Sunday, didn't we? We're getting the main Rich List this Sunday, Kevin.
Well, last Sunday was extraordinary. It was the billionaire list. And apparently London turns out to have more billionaires per head, you know, proportion to the population than anywhere else, 104. I'd have guessed there were a lot of billionaires in London, but most of those, it's fascinating that Philip's been able to find, he's been able to find their wealth because it's in recorded shareholdings, even if it's abroad. You know, if they live here, you can, there's a Russian company's house, and the owners of the big, particularly the international companies, can't hide. But you'll find that the private trusts are in Switzerland, Caymans, and that sort of stuff.
And we've got really no idea, I suppose, then, of how much money is in those. But, Martin, Britain has more billionaires per head of population. Kevin was alluding to that revelation last weekend than any other country in the world. And that's per head of population. It's just not as a number. I mean, we're in a bizarre situation here in Britain, aren't we? Where we're getting the people at the bottom end of the pile, that is to say, those maybe on benefits, disabled, mentally ill, people without work, people desperately trying to get work, are being treated worse and worse, some of them being sanctioned, as we heard earlier on, with absolutely no money to buy food, and yet we've got more billionaires per head of population than anywhere else on the planet now.
Yep. Well, I imagine that, most of the mafias of the world are headquartered in London. David Southwell, who's a very interesting journalist based in London, he's got contacts in the Metropolitan Police, and he was saying in the run-up to the Olympics, the deal is that the Met don't go after all of these criminal types that hang around in London, and they keep the street crime down. And that's a deal that the Met is quite happy to do. That's what he said. That's what he's hearing on the grapevine. Of course,
there's a very interesting one here. In Paul Raymond's time, and we can't libel anyone because he's dead. In Paul Raymond's time, there was no crime in Soho, and it was a deal. Paul, and nobody quite knows how he did it, but when Paul Raymond was the boss of the manor, there was no crime in Soho.
How did he manage to arrange that? What was the quid pro quo?
The quid pro quo was the police didn't hassle Soho.
But what were the police getting in return?
No idea. You can work it out for yourself.
Okay.
But there was no... Because I knew Soho in the era before that, when the Maltese Mafia were there, and the police... I mean, the police used to come down to Phelan's Irish pub, meet the crims, and we'd all be sent to the... I was a barman when I was a student, and we'd all be sent to the back of the bar, so we couldn't overhear anything. But these were the vice squad. So Paul Raymond gradually buys up the place, and the you could walk through Soho pissed at 4 o'clock in the morning, and nobody would hit you.
But Martin, what you seem to be implying is that actually one of the reasons we've got so many billionaires on this list is because London is becoming the mafia capital of the world.
Yeah, well, and of course they put all their kids through the British private school system as well. Britain is like a junction box for the world's dirty business, and the rules in the City of London are more permissive than Wall Street, so the really kinky stuff all goes on in the square mile.
Is that, do you think that's the case, Kevin?
Not sure. An awful lot of shady business does go on in London, because the city, the whole of London is, especially at the wealthy end, effectively unpoliced. You know, there's private security, so there's no need to deploy the Met.
I mean, we had Boris Berezovsky coming to London, didn't we? He was the oligarch, a Russian oligarch, who was warned, given 24 hours by Vladimir Putin, to get out of Russia. Said, well, look, you know, you've got 24 hours to get out, otherwise I'm afraid, you know, that it looks like that you may be arrested, but I'm just giving you that extra bit of time. He came straight to London, Martin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the relationship between Berezovsky and Putin is very interesting. If you read Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia, it becomes clear that what was happening in November 1999 was there was going to be a presidential election in Russia, which was going to be won by Gennady Zyuganov, who is the head of the Russian Communist Party. He's still the head of the Russian Communist Party, who are, in fact, the main opposition in the Duma to Putin, although you don't hear that much in the Western press. And Berezovsky and Putin together, Berezovsky was the sort of leading oligarch. He was like Murdoch. And in Russian terms, and he got to, there was a panic beginning to develop inside the oligarchy. Anatoly Chubais and others realised that if the Russian Communist Party came to power, a lot of renationalisation might take place. So suddenly, all of these bombs went off in Moscow and Ryazan, and Litvinenko in his book said, well, I was an FSB agent and we did that. And Putin rides in on a white horse and says, oh, we'll deal with this. And Gennady Zyuganov in that election eventually said, this is a straight fight now between the Communist Party and the KGB, and I call on people to vote for the Communist Party. But what happened was that Putin won. And Putin, basically, I think Putin and Berezovsky cooked up the bombings between them. But Berezovsky, of course, then fell out with Putin. Putin double-crossed his oligarchic backers and actually re-established the control of what they call the Siloviki, the security state. And you've got what you might call regulated mafia capitalism now in Russia, as opposed to unregulated mafia capitalism, which is what they had before. Berezovsky, of course, recently he died. You know, he supposedly committed suicide, but the coroner,
well, his family doesn't.
The coroner said that he couldn't say that he did commit suicide. He said there wasn't enough evidence to show that he had committed suicide. So the question is, if Berezovsky was murdered, who murdered him? And of course, it could be. It could be Putin, but it's most unlikely, because Berezovsky was pushing for the West to go on. I mean, it's extraordinary, really. Berezovsky saying, we should accuse Putin of bombing Moscow. He was going, we should accuse Putin of bombing Moscow. That will really take his legs from him. But, of course, the West doesn't really want to go there, because once we start asking questions about who's bombing things and who's shooting things, that's a mutually assured destruction between the oligarchs in the West and in the East, because they're all at it.
In your experience, Kevin, do some rich people get a little bit embarrassed about having so much wealth, and do they try and make sure that they don't appear on the rich list?
No, I mean, if you can make a case to Philip, you know, you can write to him and say you've got it all wrong. And the first rich list, one of the people who wrote and said we got it all wrong was Sullivan, you know, the guy who runs sport. And we had let him down badly. We said he was only worth 20 million. He was worth 60. Innocent days.
So is it really about vanity? People really want to be on that rich list. They want to be up high up on the rich list because it gives them publicity and a certain kudos. I'm one of the richest people in the world.
Kudos. It's a mixed blessing. You know, everybody knows who you are. You get all the begging letters. You have to close your postbox. But one person, there was years ago, what's he called? Jack Hayward, the guy who set up the Freeport in the Bahamas, was rung by Peter de Savary in these terms. De Savary rung up and said, hello, number 63, this is number 42 here. So it's a mixture, but there are a lot, especially in the lower levels, there are lots of people who want to be in it because it gives them credibility with financiers. Oh, I'm in the rich list. And the Sunday Times rich list is reliable. If you're in it, the chances of Philip getting it wrong are about 1%.
Okay, so the richest Briton is the Duke of Westminster. Guess what? He's a landowner. And he probably appears, doesn't he, in your book, Who Owns Britain, Kevin?
A lot.
To what extent does the rich list include land holdings? Because, I mean, quite a lot of these very long-term landowners, people like the Duke of Westminster, some of whom have had the same bit of land for hundreds of years, they don't appear, for example, in the land registry.
No, Grosvenor's funny. When the land registry
did... This is Grosvenor Estates, that's the Duke of Westminster's company.
He's odd in the sense that the land registry said they were having this push for registration, and Grosvenor signed up to it. You know, they were quoting him as a reference. But one of the things, the rich list isn't historic, but what it doesn't point out is the wealth of the Grosvenor Estate has tripled in one man's lifetime. That's the present Duke.
How on earth has he managed to do that? Three times? I mean, he hasn't extra land, has he?
No, he has been buying land all over the place.
But how has he... I mean, is it because he's got particularly good land that does return a massive...
You're there in one.
Okay.
He had the right sites.
So it's almost like you're on the Monopoly board if you've got Park Lane and Mayfair.
If you've got Park Lane and Mayfair and you hang on, you're never going to be poor.
Martin, about these big landowners, it does seem a little bit unfair, doesn't it, for people who are scrabbling around to get a job where somebody like the Duke of Westminster has, you know, roughly how much land does he have? Do you know, Kevin?
In the UK, about 165,000 acres. The big acreage is in Scotland, but he's got about 30,000 acres in Cheshire. But the valuable land is in London.
But for his massive wealth, he's not actually doing anything. He's not really contributing anything, is he?
No, which is one of the arguments put forward by Henry George in the last century in favour of land value taxation. And incidentally, that is kind of floating around to be discussed as the reform of local government finance might involve something like land value taxation. Because you don't want to tax entrepreneurialism. You don't want to tax people who do things, who come up with new ideas, better widgets or whatever. What you want to tax away is what economists call economic rent, which is basically where people buy their positional goods, where you don't have to do anything. The value of the land in central London rises automatically because of the economic activity that's going on around it. But that's actually a burden on entrepreneurs and the workers that they're employing. So the argument is that if you basically nationalise land, then the government then gets a fairly straightforward income from that, which means that they can lower taxes on entrepreneurs and workers. It's never come to fruition because the landowning interest has always been far too strong.
Kevin, the Attlee government after World War II actually did talk about nationalising land,
yeah,
didn't it?
They did nothing. And Lloyd George tried it. He came quite close.
Was it because the lobby is just too powerful for them to deal with?
Well, they always say it was the First World War killed the Lloyd one. I'm not sure. After the Second World War, don't know. But I think the land value taxation was appropriate before the urban house boom, when it would have delivered enormous revenue. Effectively, the country's missed the boat. It's too late to do land value taxation. If it had been introduced in 1909, the Exchequer would have had huge sums of money, as all the urban development. I mean, less than probably 10% of people owned their own homes in 1909. It then rose to 65%, and the development profits were all on that curve. But they're gone. We're now developing 14,000 acres a year. It's peanuts. It would automatically feed in and jack up the prices of houses.
I mean, it does seem just absolutely incredible that we've seen such a shooting up of these the people at the very richest end of the spectrum, and yet we're talking about nearly a million people now taking food bank handouts. Mm-hmm. Martin, this does look as if what we're doing is almost like a sort of cell dividing. You know, you've got one side doing extremely well, and they're using that wealth and power to lobby political parties to get the law changed, to actually take even more wealth from the poor.
Well, I've just read a very interesting book by a guy called Philip Mirofsky, and it's called Don't Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste. And basically, the book is fairly high powered, but it's basically he's trying to answer the question, how is it after the crash of 2008 that this free market, super rich philosophy has actually been strengthened rather than undermined? And the book actually goes into how that's happened, because it's if you like, it's almost like a bit like Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. The crisis has actually been very good for the super wealthy. Hmm. They haven't, in fact, lost anything at all. In fact, they've gained from it. And any hopes that we had, I mean, when the crash happened and we had a Labour government in power, I thought, they'll be forced into radical measures here. But the bank nationalisation never really came to fruition, either in Britain or America. What we did is we just gave loads of money to the private bankers and told them to go back to the casino.
Well, by saying sort of no strings attached, really.
Yes, that's the whole point.
Kevin, I mean, let's try and address this, because something has to be done about this, politically. What sort of policy might do? I mean, you've said land value taxation you don't think nowadays would work. So how do we address this increasing divide between rich and poor?
Well, one of the things that was starting to address it, only it's been stopped in its tracks, and the left should have spotted this coming with Thatcher. As the number of people who owned their own homes grew, that proportion of the population with an asset grew. What everybody forgets is history. That development, the development of home ownership, took an enormous number of the 19th century poor off the poverty list. It was a way of taking people off poverty. It wasn't perfect, and it left a lot of people out, but it was working. And the Thatcher government in particular seems to have spotted that. and, you know, tried to get us all back to, have you heard about it, buy to rent. They want to turn us back into the 19th century, where everybody rented, because that's what gives rentiers and big capitalists money. But the reforms that are necessary have to occur much further down the chain. I don't think nationalising land is really going to contribute much, if anything.
Because we're living now in generation rent. We keep hearing this expression. Young people are just saying, well, it's going to be impossible for me to ever own my own property, so I'm going to be renting. And these rentier class seems to be absolutely in control of the policy.
Yep. And I think it was conscious. I think that the people in the Thatcher government knew what they were doing. And, you know, and Labour never reversed this. The only way to reverse it was to keep housing cheap enough for people to buy it and keep getting more and more people into it. Instead, you know, we're headed for 50-50, you know, and dropping back by 15%. The left never fully understand that the, if you like, tax at everything wasn't what was actually getting poor people off the dung heap. It was, you know, the progressive ownership of homes. An asset. And the only way to change that totally will be to end the market.
Well, we certainly have got a lot of owner-occupiers in Ireland, haven't we? There was a big land reform went on over there in the late 1800s, and it led to a lot of small... I mean, we're talking about mostly rural, actually, but a lot of small landowners. It's anyway... because it was reversing the the historical trend towards conglomerating into bigger and bigger estates, reversing that completely and turning people who had been renting into small landowners, Kevin.
Yeah, it was a sort of successful policy, but just before the boom, poverty was, what would you call it, a hobby of the rich. They would adopt poor people. You know, you'd have your wealthy Dublin middle class, and they'd be going out to the poor slums, which were very few. By the time the bust came, poverty in Ireland was very, very nearly gone, 8% less.
But that was one of the reasons why the British kind of maybe lost a bit of heart in Ireland, is because they weren't able to collect the vast amounts of rent that they had been before the land reform.
Oh, there was a real... you see it in the literature when you're reading the landowners' letters and things of the time. They were petrified. And they were petrified it was going to turn up here. You know, they and there were rural riots in Wales and in Scotland. I mean, the Marines were sent in. Nobody see that just doesn't appear in history. But as I said, I am obviously not all that popular with certain parts of the, if you like, this, the left-wing establishment, because you don't achieve the removal of poverty by, you know, giving the task to civil servants. You don't. I mean, the Soviet Union proved that central planning doesn't work.
Martin, what
on the other hand, there's China.
Well, all right, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, there is a precedent there. Back, I mean, it's a long way back in history. It may be a bit esoteric through the Irish Land League and the campaign that went on in Ireland saying, well, look, you know, we're fed up with paying all this rent. And in a way, the people, the separatists in Ukraine are a similar crew, aren't they? Because they're saying, well, we've been paying all these taxes to Kiev and we haven't been seeing anything in the return. In the same way, the peasant farmers in Ireland were saying, to the British, they were saying, we're paying all this money to the landowning classes, absentee landowners in Ireland, and we're fed up with it.
Well, there's quite a lot of different issues.
I'm bringing Ukraine in as a sort of bit of a cross.
Yeah, I mean, let's just pick up on central planning. I think the Soviet Union was obviously a basket case, but that doesn't what you might call market conforming interventions are not necessarily stupid. I take your point that having lots of owner occupation would be fine. In Singapore, for example, the government built lots and lots of housing and then sold it. So they are creating the market, and in a sense you could say, well, selling council houses is not necessarily a bad idea as long as you build new ones. But that's not what's happened, is it?
That's not what happened. And the amazing thing is Thatcher's Tory party, the biggest funders were builders and developers, and she decimated them. The 500,000 jobs got knocked out of the, you know, building industry, because she sold off the council houses and building didn't follow.
Well, don't forget, there aren't just rational policies being pursued here. And what you've also got is political manipulation going on. But most of those people who bought their own houses bought them at a discount, so they've basically been given a free handout by the government. And that tends... I mean, I used to live in Fulham during that era, and I remember reading a letter in the Fulham Chronicle from a local saying, well, I've been a Labour voter all my life, but buying my house at the price I've been buying it, I've just been given thousands and thousands of pounds by the government. I feel almost obliged to change my vote. And of course, the other thing is, once you've got a mortgage, it's more difficult to go on strike. These kind of things that are definitely... I mean, the home ownership philosophy in Britain has been pushed since the 1920s as part of a political economic package. But in other parts of Northern Europe, the people ownership of houses is not regarded as a big deal, even for quite wealthy middle-class people. They just rent because they all do.
Kevin, I have to take issue with you there, though, over... You were saying, talking about the Conservatives selling out the house building industry. Nowadays, what we're seeing, actually, is an opening up for the house building industry. For example, up here in Filton, chatting to some developer, maybe probably shouldn't name, saying that these are actually the worst houses that are being built anywhere across the southwest, cheap and nasty, with no proper pavements, for example, outside the front doors of some of them at the moment. And actually, what they're doing there is they are selling into a very, very, very buoyant market with government assistance for people to buy them.
The help to buy. But there, if you actually track the change in wealth and poverty from, say, 1900, you find that the thing that was doing the most was home ownership. What happened was Thatcher brought a halt to that. And now we're heading back where, as yourself and Martin say, young people can't buy a home. But the fracturing of the policy, the failure to maintain the housing market and stop it booming and busting, keep it fairly stable, is another failure. The one instrument of change is effectively in reverse.
But you're saying that Thatcher stopped it, that the homeowners... Actually, surely she was doing the opposite. She was opening up home ownership to a lot of people of the social housing, which previously they hadn't been allowed to buy.
But nobody analysed it. And Martin's right there on it. She sold off the housing, the council housing, didn't replace it, which left scope for a bust or boom in the future. Now we're in the kind of classic, what you call slum builders. That's what you're talking about. They're not building houses, they're building slums.
Okay, well, this whole subject of the billionaires and the gap between rich and poor came up with the West Wales MP at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week. It was Jonathan Edwards' question.
Jonathan Edwards.
Dear York, Mr. Speaker, the UK now has 104 billionaires, top of the global league. London alone has 72 billionaires, the top city in the world. Meanwhile, West Wales and the Valleys is also in the top five poorest regions in Western Europe. Is the Prime Minister at all concerned? Or is he, like Labour's Lord Mandelson, intensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich?
Yeah. What I can say to the Honourable Gentleman, what is worthwhile, is the massive fall in unemployment and the increase in employment that we've seen across our country. In terms of in Wales today, in Wales, unemployment has fallen by 5,000 in the last quarter and fallen by 25,000 since the last election. That means that in Wales there are 59,000 more people in work. In terms of making sure that the richest in our country pay their taxes, actually we see the richest 1% paying a greater percentage of income tax than ever they did under Labour. What we're seeing is a broad-based recovery, and I want to make sure that everyone in our country can benefit, and that's why we're cutting people's taxes and allowing people to keep the first £10,000 of what they earn before they pay any income tax.
Well, quite a robust reply by the Prime Minister there, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist. But what he's saying is that actually what's happening is things aren't getting worse for the poorest. That actually more and more people, unemployment's coming down. And even though people haven't got full-time work, more and more people are in work.
Well, we covered a lot of this in the first hour, as you know, Tony. As I pointed out earlier, the economy is only just beginning to be at the same size as it was before the crash. But we've now got the highest number of people employed in Britain ever, 30 million plus. That means that productivity per worker has collapsed. which it has, which means that these new jobs are low-paid, low-skill, part-time jobs. The other thing is that business investment is still lagging. The private sector itself doesn't believe in this recovery, and it's all based on the usual property bubble. Being especially helped, I mean, the IMF have criticised Osborne's Help to Buy. Lord Lawson has said they've got to stop it in London. We're on the road to disaster, as we've seen it before with when Lawson was in charge. The barber. It's very like a 60s boomlet. This it's geared to the electoral cycle. They're hoping that the economy will carry on booming through the next year, so that they can squeak back in. But it's based on sand, and of course the international economy is really in a very desperate state, and that's going to overwhelm them all.
Why are people like Nigel Lawson saying that they should stop it in London?
Because it's obviously getting out of control already. If they don't stop Help to Buy, eventually Mark Carney, if he really is independent, will raise interest rates to bring this back under control. But when they do that, the economy will crash. This is the problem. It doesn't just slow down. If you raise interest rates at this stage to try and stop the housing bubble, this is very, very common. It's happened all the time. It's called stop-go, they used to call it in the 1960s, or it's really go-stop. British economy picks up, the property bubble starts to expand in the southeast particularly. Then you have to raise interest rates to rein that in, and that crashes the economy in places like Blackpool and South Wales. And we've been here before umpteen times. The same thing is going to happen. They're just hoping that the crash doesn't come before election day.
Kevin, what about that particular point there about the difference between rich and poor? Let's come back to try and address this, because this isn't going away. As Martin's been pointing out, there may be some sort of problems with when the bubble bursts, but at the moment we're seeing a real separation between the two.
Yeah, I mean, at the bottom end, and the bottom end is growing, you know. As both of you have said, and we all know, most of the jobs are, you know, poorly paid, part-time, whatever, and state-subsidised in lots of cases. Mm-hmm. You know, the state has to subsidise people's wages. So there's something really flawed at the back end of the economy. You know, at the front end, people with houses are in another boom. At the back end, there's a growing number of people who A, can't buy a house, and B, are in dreadful jobs that are, you know, and certainly this government is not addressing that back end, the low quality of the jobs and the lack of real, if you might, the kind of infrastructure we need if we're to grow again.
So if you had the ear of George Osborne, what would you be advising him to do? Any thoughts on that one? I know it's not the easiest question, but how could it be addressed?
But Osborne would be the wrong person, because he doesn't believe in basics. The current Tories do not believe in gradually empowering and gradually improving the economic standing of most of the population.
Okay, so who would you buttonhole in?
Nobody in the present government, that's for sure.
So you don't think they could do anything?
They could if they wanted to, but it would need... Here's the problem. You'd need a cross-party consensus about what it is that gets people off the dung heap.
Well, I mean, one of the things basically would be to go again for full employment. This is something that was talked about after World War II, saying, you know, idleness was terrible for everybody, so let's just make sure there's enough jobs for all. Is that feasible?
In the present state of the British economy, it's not. We are far too far down the high-tech chain for a start. The high-tech, where all the money was, and a lot of other things, was crushed in this country in the 80s. I chronicled the disaster. Nobody was listening. So we'll trug along roughly where they are, where we are. But we're not, unless we do more to get real jobs in real industries that can export and everything else, we're not going anywhere.
Well, one of the industries which is supposedly on the up, which is going to apparently save us, going to help the economy, is fracking. Business, and this is from a couple of years ago in Business Wire, business and financial leaders Lord Rothschild and Rupert Murdoch invest in Genie Oil and Gas. Jacob Rothschild and Mr. Murdoch separately purchased big equity portions equivalent to a cumulative 5.5% stake in Genie Oil and Gas, which consists of IDT's interest in American shale oil AMSO and Israel Energy Initiatives Limited for a total of $11 million. Now, these are the sort of people that you find on the rich list. They're investing a lot of their money in fracking.
Well, the fracking issue has to break over environmental concerns. Economically, fracking has turned the United States around. The United States was in as big a hole as we were. And it's boom time. They're exporting oil and everything. And the issue boils down to, is the damage to the environment worth it? And it's not an easy one to answer. I think fracking can probably be made as safe as anything else. But that's how the issue splits.
I mean, is it enough to... I mean, this, it makes them incredibly destructive to the environment, fracking. And what they're saying is, oh, well, the economy is in such a terrible position that only this can rescue us. Isn't that a bit of a con?
Well, no, there are other ways of doing it, but that would definitely, to judge by the United States, the quick fix is fracking.
Martin, also dwelling on the Rothschild family, Rothschilds and Rockefellers, this is from May 2012, teamed up for extra wealth creation, it says in the Daily Telegraph, an article by Alistair Osborne. Rothschild and Rockefeller families teamed up to buy assets from banks and other distressed sellers in a union between the two, the best known names in financial history. Rockefeller and Rothschild, RIT Capital Partners, which is chaired by Lord Rothschild, took a 37% stake in Rockefeller Financial Services. What they're doing here basically is creating a big wealth fund to look around the Western world, and as the economic crisis kicks in and companies go to the wall, they're snapping them up for peanuts.
Mm. Yeah, and they'll be looking to pick up some stuff in the Ukraine, I'm sure, which brings me back to the fracking. I've been reading stuff by a guy called William Engdahl, and he sees the fracking largely as a bubble. In other words, that people are pushing fracking as the solution, wealthy people are investing in it, but he says in actual fact the technology isn't as wonderful in terms of making money as people imagine. And what's happening, of course, what's happening in Ukraine is the EU is now being put under pressure to sign this trade agreement with the US. And because under that trade agreement, we could then get some of the fracked oil from the US to make up for the Russian oil, gas, which is coming through, may not come through if Putin pulls the plug. I don't know. I mean, Engdahl's usually pretty good. So when he flags up and says that this is probably a bubble, I'm inclined to believe him. I just don't believe in recovery on the basis of printing money, whether in the Britain or the US. Ultimately, the dollar is going to crash, possibly as a result of the geopolitical conflict over the Ukraine. And at that point, all of this stuff about recovery is going to sound pretty sick.
Could we address the Ukraine? Because there are extraordinary curiosities not mentioned in the Western media. The first is, the Ukraine is on the border of Russia. What on earth is the United States doing interfering 8,000 miles from the United States? The Ukraine is between us and Russia. Why is the United States rattling sabres and interfering? And the second thing is, the Velvet Revolution in 2004 was financed by the United States. You know, you finance revolution, and eventually, of course, you get a revolution, and it doesn't always turn out to be what you want. Any half-decent analyst in the first year of university strategic course would have said, if anything goes wrong, the Ukraine loses the Crimea. It's Russian. It was so obvious. And if you like, America and the West walked straight into it.
But people on the streets there now, Kevin, it's been very much a resistance against the new government in Kiev for many of the regions in the east of Ukraine. How do you think that's all going to pan out? I mean, do you have sympathy for people who've decided, well, we want nothing to do with this new government?
I think the difficulty is fundamental. Part of the Ukraine, I mean, Russia came out of the Kievan Russia was the first Russia. It was actually Ukrainian. So there's an intense mix of, you know, Russians and Ukrainians in the same place. And I think some kind of split is probably inevitable, no matter what you might think, right or wrong.
Okay.
The Russian people in the Ukraine want much greater freedom. It's interesting, Putin is peddling very carefully there.
Back to the rich list anyway, yeah. I mentioned the Rothschilds and Rockefellers there. I mean, these are two massive dynasties, the Rockefellers in the US and the Rothschilds in Europe, many of the countries in Europe, Switzerland, France, Britain, etc., Germany. What are your thoughts about them? Because you don't see the Jacob Rothschild there on the rich list, which does rather puzzle me, because he's an incredibly wealthy man, extremely influential. Maybe he's just one of these people that's quite good at hiding his wealth. And I can remember, this is a couple of weeks, a couple of years ago, where they had the Sunday Times rich list. I bought the Sunday Times, got the supplement, and there was no mention of Jacob Rothschild at all. And yet you opened it up to the, I think it was second or third page, and there's a big advert for Rothschild's wine. And it was almost like a sort of a Mickey take, you know, an in-joke.
It's the key rule in the rich list. If his assets aren't visible, he doesn't have them. The implication is all Rothschild's assets are offshore, or in trusts that are impenetrable, because they still have big houses here and they've got lots of land.
Yeah, so in a way, it renders these rich lists a bit of an illusion. It's like, well, we're looking at who are the richest people, but these aren't actually really the richest people. What are your thoughts about that particular dynasty and, you know, what sort of power they wield today and wealth?
Well, they seem to wield enormous power. The super rich are another race, in a sense, and they would be at the very top table in that bunch. They don't live on the same planet as we do. But why has nobody followed up the fact? You know, if you're going to have a rich list, then you make a lot of use of the rich list for all sorts of things. Why has nobody elsewhere in the media, Philip can't do everything, why has nobody in the media said, well, where are their assets? Where are their assets? And I think we might find it wouldn't take very long, really. But if you think of the media groups, the Telegraph's owned by the Barclay brothers, billionaires offshore. Murdoch owns the News International, billionaire offshore. Desmond is much the same. And you think they're going to go and do an investigation into one of their mates?
Well, you've got a big job for us there, Kevin, to do.
Well, there's a lovely vacancy for the ones who aren't on the rich list.
I mean, the trouble is a lot of this wealth is held in private companies, private businesses, where the shareholdings aren't easy. It's very difficult to actually find out who's got the shares, who owns the shares, how much value. The other thing is they sometimes have a company that they own, and that will be considered to be a director of another company. So there's all sorts of ways that these people use to hide their wealth.
No, in the company's house register here, it's not that difficult, provided they're onshore. The shareholders have to be identified. Even now, I mean, they're talking about making it even more stringent. But without those share registers, Philip wouldn't be able to do the list.
Well, there is one film around, and it's called The Rothschild Myths. So let's have a little listen to that one now and see what Kevin makes of this. It's a couple of minutes of exploring the history and the wealth of the Rothschilds.
Just how rich and powerful is Lord Evelyn Rothschild? Historically, the Rothschild family wealth was hidden in underground vaults. The Rothschild's secret financial records were never audited and never accounted for. Their family commissioned biographies give the illusion that their family fortune has dwindled, but researchers estimate their wealth at close to $500 trillion, more than half the wealth of the entire world. Besides their many castles, palace mansions, wineries, racehorses, and exotic resorts, the Rothschilds bought Reuters in the 1800s. Reuters then bought the Associated Press, which selects and delivers the same news stories to the entire world, day after day. They have controlling interest in three major television networks and easily avoid media attention since they own it. Until recently, they owned and operated England's Royal Mint and continue to be the gold agent for the Bank of England, which they also direct. They control the LBMA, London Bullion Market Association, where 30 to 42 million ounces of gold worth over $11 billion are traded daily. The Rothschilds earn millions weekly just on transaction fees alone. They also fix the world price of gold on a daily basis and profit from its ups and downs. Over the centuries, the Rothschilds have amassed trillions of dollars worth of gold bullion in their subterranean vaults and have cornered the world's gold supply. They own controlling interest in the world's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell. They operate phony charities and offshore banking services where the wealth of the black nobility and the Vatican is hidden in secret accounts at Rothschild Swiss banks, trusts, and holding companies. The wealth hoarded by this one family alone could feed, clothe, and shelter every human being on Earth.
Well, that's a YouTube clip there called "The Myths, the Rothschild Myths." But Kevin, very difficult to substantiate some of the things that are being said. We have to say, but certainly the Rothschilds do take a great interest in the gold market, don't they?
They're part of the London Fix, which fixes the price for the world. They are the key. They sit on the, you know, the group. And they're the key people in it.
I mean, to what extent do you think that that was a bit of speculation, or do you think there's some facts peppered in there?
Some of it's, some of that is, I prefer, but who's going to do it? Somebody to sit down and actually go through it. If you're operating big like that, actually, what you're doing can be traced. But who's going to pay for it to be done? In this, and it's a media issue. You know, we hear nothing about it because the media doesn't research it, and perhaps if they did, it wouldn't be reported anyway.
And what they're implying there is that much of the media is owned by some of these big families and certainly big investments in them. Yeah. I can remember seeing Rupert Murdoch interviewed by Fox News just before the phone hacking scandal blew up. And, I mean, this is one of his employees, and he gave him an icy stare and said, "Do you really want me to walk out of the studio?" And so that kind of relationship, when it's a journalist inquiring into their own boss and, you know, how the management of the their media that they're working for is operating, all starts to get a little bit peculiar. Anyway, Kevin, thanks very much for joining us to discuss some of the things on the Rich List. It's all out, I think, isn't it? The full list this Sunday.
The full list this Sunday.
Thanks very much.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Google is looming as the censor-in-chief after the Right to Be Forgotten ruling. This is in the Huffington Post. Europe's top court has ruled that forces the internet search engines to remove links containing embarrassing materials about an individual's past. It may have significant implications in the future of freedom of speech online. Martin, this immediately, I'm afraid, makes me concerned, worried, because it means that individuals who are written about in articles may be able to just sort of lobby through the courts to say, "Oh, I don't want that article online," just because it's a bit embarrassing.
Well, yeah, I mean, they also take a lot of stuff down because of copyright infringement, don't they? So in a sense,
but this is a new, this is a new,
well, this is a new development.
Development, yeah. Just one, here's an example of something from the Evening Post, which has recently removed them in the internet, and I'll just read through it. This was posted online in July 2008 by Vicky Mathias. A Bristol-based journalist has launched a legal action against a man she claims is a former lover. A High Court writ was issued by freelance writer Christina Zaba of Lee Woods. She says, she fears a former Western Daily Press reporter Roger Taverner will publish an intimate video made while they were having an affair. Ms. Zaba claims that Mr. Taverner has harassed her by email, letter and by text message since their alleged relationship deteriorated, and she's concerned that he will publish the video or images from the tape on the internet or to third parties. Her solicitors say this would equate to a breach of her human rights. She's seeking an injunction against Mr. Taverner of Clifton to prevent him harassing her or making the video public. Mr. Taverner was not available for comment when the Post tried to contact him last night. Well, maybe I could bring you back in again here, Kevin, because this is just an article that was appeared in a newspaper, and now it's just disappeared off the internet. The paper has been written to, saying that the accuracy of it is disputed, and it's disappeared from history.
Well, the core problem is we all need privacy, okay, and it's how to strike the balance between the two. Obviously, people like us journalists like to be able to see who's been doing bad things.
But this is just a report of a court action, an injunction.
But yeah, it's a very, very tricky one, because without privacy, we can't exist.
But without journalism, I mean, you know,
There's no absolute either way.
Martin, in the balance here, what we've got is if you're allowed to report a court case that someone afterwards thinks, well, I'd rather that hadn't been reported.
I think the court case, you've got to report that.
Yep.
It's a whole point about courts is that they're public.
This is about a High Court writ.
Well, yes, but I mean, the fact is that that's the public document, isn't it, which anybody should be able to access. I think the problem is, if this chap has got, you know, intimate video of himself and Christina, it's very difficult for her to stop him using it if that's what he wants to do. You know, you can put it up anonymously off some server somewhere, and you know, who can stop you?
What about the this right, though, the right to forget? Is there such a thing, Kevin?
Well, I mean, yes, the right to forget is recognised in law. Spent convictions, which the British media, particularly the tabloids, ignore.
But the silly thing about this is that you could go to a library, you could pull out that edition of the newspaper, and there it is.
Yeah.
And it's nothing legally wrong with it. The difference is that you're now trying to say, well, this part of the internet, I don't like this, and I'm going to make sure it's removed.
Yeah, it's...
I suppose it's because the internet is like a giant library, isn't it?
I would go along with Martin. If it's in the courts, you don't have the right to take it down. It's public record. Conversely, the people who've done the most damage to that principle are the tabloids, who, you know, drag up stuff from 50 years ago. It's tricky. But the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act was a socialist measure to try and get people who'd got a record back into work. So tricky.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Big article in the Newsweek International this week, Martin, which was about Israelis spying on the US. I mean, they are saying this is virtually a secret story that never gets out normally. So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, I saw that the US Defense Secretary was poo-pooing all of this and saying that there was no real evidence. There is. Jonathan Pollard was arrested by the US authorities for selling nuclear secrets to the Israelis, which were then sold on to the Russians in the 1970s. He's still in prison. The other thing, of course, is the five dancing Israelis on 9/11 who were... basically filming the first plane hitting the Twin Towers, clapping and cheering and giving high fives. They were arrested 8 hours later by the local police and interrogated. They went back to Israel and they were said on Israeli television, Piers Seglovitz, I think it was, saying, oh, well, we were just documenting the event. There's nothing for people to see here. How did Israeli agents, because that's what they were Mossad agents, how did they know that that plane was going to hit the tower? And why were they in exactly the right place to film it, which is what they were doing? These questions need to be answered.
Well, back in 2001, good old Fox News, we love to hate them, they did a report exactly on this very subject, and the reporter was Carl Cameron.
Dr. Ailey Whiteford.
Yeah. Nope, don't think that was Carl Cameron. Sorry about that. Now let's have Carl Cameron.
Los Angeles, 1997. A major local, state, and federal drug investigation sours. The suspects? Israeli organized crime, with operations in New York, Miami, Las Vegas, Canada, Israel, and Egypt. The allegations? Cocaine and ecstasy trafficking, and sophisticated white-collar credit card and computer fraud. The problem? According to classified law enforcement documents obtained by Fox News, the bad guys had the cops' beepers, cell phones, even home phones under surveillance. Some who did get caught admitted to having hundreds of numbers and using them to avoid arrest. Quote, this compromised law enforcement communications between LAPD detectives and other assigned law enforcement officers working various aspects of the case. The organization discovered communications between Organized Crime Intelligence Division detectives, the FBI, and the Secret Service. Shock spread from the DEA to the FBI in Washington and then the CIA. An investigation of the problem, according to law enforcement documents, concluded, quote, the organization has apparent extensive access to database systems to identify pertinent personal and biographical information. When investigators tried to find out where the information might have come from, they looked at Amdocs, a publicly traded firm based in Israel. Amdocs generates billing data for virtually every call in America, and they do credit checks. The company denies any leaks, but investigators still fear that the firm's data is getting into the wrong hands. When investigators checked their own wiretapping system for leaks, they grew concerned about potential vulnerabilities in the computers that intercept, record, and store the wiretapped calls. A main contractor is Comverse Infosys, which works closely with the Israeli government and under a special grant program is reimbursed for up to 50% of its research and development costs by Israel's Ministry of Industry and Trade. Asked this week about another sprawling investigation and the detention of 60 Israelis since September 11th, the Bush administration treated the questions like hot potatoes.
I would just refer you to Department of Justice with it. I'm not familiar with the report.
I'm aware that some Israeli citizens have been detained. With respect to why they are being detained and the other aspects of your question, whether it's because they are in intelligence services or what they were doing, I will defer to the Department of Justice and the FBI to answer that.
Martin, that was Carl Cameron's report from 2001 on Fox News. Why is this usually hushed up? So we don't hear a lot about this, and yet there you've got a big network of Israeli spies infiltrating the entire US telecommunications system.
Well, I think there are elements within the US armed forces who are very, very worried about this. And those people, we need to, I look to those people to do something about it. The Israelis are, in fact, well out of control. They work very closely with organised crime, and a lot of them have got dual Russian-Israeli nationality.
OK, time to sign off now. It's time for the Murdoch News at 7. And thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Alistair Watson, and also to Kevin Carhill. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Have a good weekend, a nice sunny Saturday tomorrow, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, at least 10 people are now known to have died in two explosions in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Nearly 70 others were injured in the blasts in a market. The Foreign Office has recommended people from the UK don't travel to several parts of Kenya, with hundreds of British holidaymakers being flown back home. This couple arrived back at Gatwick Airport earlier and say the situation on the ground was slightly chaotic.
Minimal information from the very beginning, to be honest.
Gutted, because obviously it's ruined our holiday. But on the other hand, obviously, you've got to be safe.
Former It's a Knockout host Stuart Hall's been found guilty of indecently assaulting a girl aged under 16, but a jury has cleared him of 19 other charges, including rape. The 84-year-old didn't react as the verdicts were read out. Police have used tear gas.